This program is sponsored by Wicked Chronic in Natick, Massachusetts. Located at 185 Worcester Street, right on Route 9, they can be reached at 508-545-8105 or at wickedchronicvendorcommerce.com. Wicked Chronic is a boutique-style retail shop that focuses on selling counterculture products such as Wiccan, cannabis cultures coming together in a unique setting. You need something for that special spell? Go on down to Wicked Chronic in Natick, Massachusetts and speak to Beverly. Tell them Dr. Chris sent you. Check them out today.
Until now.
Have we met before?
10 years ago.
The one they couldn't kill is back.
Every single person in those photos has turned up dead.
His revenge is sweet. His method, shocking.
Don't you come any closer.
The Electrocutioner on Friday the 13th. The series. See what kind of man can beat the chair. Next week.
Welcome to the Dead TV Podcast, a podcast dedicated to all the canceled television shows in the science fiction, fantasy, and horror genre. I am your host, Dr. Chris.
And I'm Mr. Seneca.
And we continue our coverage of Friday the 13th, the television series, with tonight's podcast being The Electrocutioner.
The Electrocutioner, which is Season 1, Episode 17, originally aired on April 18th, 1988. A dentist uses a cursed electric chair to seek revenge against those who wronged him.
What's kind of funny, though, is that I don't think anyone's really wronged in this episode, but we'll get to that. I mean...
He was... they tried to kill him, and he was innocent, so I guess that is a type of wronging. But I think
so.
That would be more on the court system versus the actual execution staff.
Yeah, but we'll get to that. So his original execution is planned for in 1978, and he's at Evanclaw Federal Penitentiary. Is there an Evanclaw Federal Penitentiary?
No, there is not.
Okay. Do we know how many people were executed in 1978?
I don't have that metric.
Ah, okay. All right. Well, let's see if we can.
Let's see. Old Sparky. Since we don't exactly know where the execution takes place, what state? Each state has their execution rates and when they stopped using the electric chair in different times. Mm-hmm. So like in Kentucky, it was first used in 1911, and then last was 1997.
You know, what's funny is that if you type in under the capital punishment like website, they list California as having the lowest number of executions since 1978. This is always usually due to people being backed up on the executioner list.
Wow, yeah.
There are people there are people who have been on the execution list for apparently over 30 years.
Well, it makes sense because you really don't want to execute an innocent man or woman.
True.
And that's what this whole episode is about. Is they tried to kill an innocent person. He was found out to be innocent after the fact. But, you know, this electric chair electrocuted him. They turned off the juice. Heart rate was still there. They did it again. Heart rate was not there. They took him off, declared dead. But yet, he came back to life. So, it's that gray area where you've been declared dead, so therefore you are no longer a person, according to the government.
Now, according to the deathpenaltyinformation.org website, which I cannot believe there was actually one, but hell, sure, there's a website for everything. Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Maryland, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, Nevada, New Hampshire, New Mexico, North Carolina, Ohio, Oklahoma, Oregon, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Virginia, Washington, Wyoming and the United States government itself, which means federal penitentiary, which I don't think has a specific location, there was nobody executed in 1978.
Okay, so that's, you know, pretty much like half the states, right?
I think, yeah, over half the states. These are all the states that actually have the death penalty. I unfortunately live in the most Hippocratic state of all time, Massachusetts. You live in a state with the death penalty, so don't go around killing anyone, Mr. Zeneca.
If I killed someone, you wouldn't know it.
Oh, right. Sure. That's what they all say. However, I think after what you told me happened last time somebody in Philadelphia won a championship, you might kill somebody.
Well, I mean, the Eagles have won their place into the Super Bowl, and everyone's going completely nuts out here. So you just never know. It's kind of a crapshoot here in Philadelphia. So, should we start in on the episode?
Yes, after playing the Fox fanfare for the NFL, sure.
All right. This episode starts in the most, like, cliched way. You know, it was a dark and stormy night, and it's black and white footage of the Evan Claw Federal Penitentiary in 1978. So, I do like the fact that they actually used black and white footage to indicate the past, even though according to the timeline it's only 10 years previous. I just like the fact that they used black and white film just to indicate that this is a past event. You know, it's not something that's kind of, you know, 30, 40 years previous. It's only 10 years. But, you know, I thought it was a nice touch. It was probably very difficult to do within the technical means at the time. So we see all of the steps to going to the electric chair. You know, it's very anxiety-ridden. They're shaving his head, all of that. And one thing that I noticed that they didn't do, which we kind of learned if you're a fan of prison media, that as we learned from, like, the Green Mile, they do not put a sponge on his head with water to be a good conductor for the electricity. It's just kind of like a metal basket thing that is attached to the chair.
That was kind of strange. It looks like a strainer.
Yeah, like almost a, I don't know, it reminded me of those wire baskets that you hang onions or oranges in your kitchen, but just inverted.
A little bit.
And so he is prisoner, I couldn't read it, whether it's AC-1317 or AG-1317.
Now, did you ever see a movie called Shocker?
Shocker. Maybe a long time ago.
It was a Wes Craven-directed movie starring Mitch Pileggi, a.k.a. Walter Skinner from The X-Files. And it's about a death row inmate who's electrocuted but lives on and goes after the people.
Oh, so pretty much the same type of plot here, except he doesn't have the supernatural power with the electricity, or no?
Yeah, he's got, like, supernatural powers.
Ah, okay. It seems that whenever someone gets electrocuted and survive, they somehow gain electrical powers. Happens in comic books, happens in movies, happens on TV. It's just one of those tropes that, you know, it survives, even though the actual effects of electrical damage to your body are devastating. It's like your entire immune system and nervous system kind of goes haywire while the electricity is running through you. And then afterwards, people that have been struck by lightning are more apt to actually get hit again because your body somehow is now an attractant to those, you know, electrical beams. You are now the place of least resistance on the landscape. Mm-hmm. So people that have been struck by lightning, you know, fear getting struck again for good reason.
The writer of the episode, Rob Hedden, went on to write Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan, among some of his credits.
Oh.
He'd also written over 15 episodes of MacGyver leading up to this episode and passed it as well.
Oh, okay. So he's got some creds there.
Television director as well. Oh, he was also the director of Friday the 13th Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan, which came out in 1989. So probably the summer of after this episode would air. Also wrote one of my most ridiculous kind of guilty pleasure movies called Clockstoppers, which was actually directed by Jonathan Franks, a.k.a. Will Riker of Star Trek The Next Generation fame.
Oh, cool. Cool.
Okay, the big question I have is, even if you're a reformed convict, because later on we find out this guy actually didn't do what they are accusing him of doing, which, you know, he keeps saying he's innocent, but who is going to let somebody become a dentist? But this is like a reform prison school or something that he's in?
Yeah, basically he gets put onto the staff at Haverstock Reform School. So what that is, it's basically a school for wayward teenagers that have been that are runaways, that have problems with the law, and they're trying to still have an educational system, but now it is funded by the state. And I guess they hired a dentist on staff. Now, it is mentioned, though, that he did change his name in order to become the doctor. So instead of Eli Pittman, his name was changed to Dr. Christian Lindheim. So he does have actual the dentistry credentials. You know, it's mentioned in the episode that he had went through 4 years of dental school before getting put into prison. So therefore, he actually does know what he's doing with dentistry. So it was probably easy to convince them to hire him.
I just definitely would never want somebody I know who probably been to prison for murder work on my teeth.
You know, I don't really have a problem with convicts, for the most part.
I don't have a problem
as long
with
as
convicts,
they're not like violent against me. And if he was proven innocent, then he should be cleared of all wrongdoing.
Once again, it's like, is the object that he's in possession of, which is the electric chair, which he got at a, you know, it's just a coincidence that he was able to obtain the electric chair from Uncle Lewis. Uncle Lewis obtained it in an auction for curious goods. And then it's by coincidence this guy was able to know where the electric chair was in order to obtain it.
That's what's a little confusing here, because he was nearly electrocuted by this electric chair. So which seems to me that it was actually cursed before Uncle Lewis got his hands on it. And then Uncle Lewis got it because of reputation or, you know, evil deeds, and it increased its devil power? I don't know.
Well, I mean, Uncle Lewis didn't make that deal with the devil and then start collecting the objects. He made the deal with the devil after he collected all those objects.
That's true, but he kept gathering new objects while that deal was in place.
Okay, but does that deal... So that deal is null and void once he's dead and all the objects that they obtain or anything they buy from anybody off the streets because they're still running it like an antique store wouldn't become cursed?
I believe that would be correct.
Okay.
Because remember, in the first episode in The Inheritance, Jack provides Lewis with objects. These objects weren't cursed before they entered Lewis's hands. And then they became cursed, and then as Lewis sold them off. But the antique store still has tons of objects there that aren't locked in the vault. So those cannot be cursed, or at least they aren't cursed, so that the antique store can still maintain, you know, a revenue stream.
He is killing off random people just for the power to be able to take the power from the chair in order to go around killing people. This whole episode really loses it when he starts doing that. I mean, if they had better writers to come up with ideas about how he could get people in the chair to kill them, that would be fine. But him killing these random students that I think are mentioned later on as to be runaways doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It's the weakest part of the entire plot line.
I would agree.
I mean, I know it's called
the
election.
It would be like, you know, every time you use the object, you're basically killing two people. You kill the person that you're sucking the energy from, and then you kill your target.
I understand the episode's called The Electrocutioner and not The Electric Chair, but still, the curse and the villain center around the object itself, and the electric chair gives him electric powers when it drains the life force from people is not very well explained whatsoever. Like, he kills the young black teenager, and he kills the punk rock girl, who's really high, because history's really high, man. History class is history. It's fun to be high. That's what I wrote in my notes. By the way, she's like, "You're such a nice guy. Now you're dead."
I mean, this was filmed in 1988, and she totally has the Susie and the Banshees look about her.
Uh-huh.
Kind of hot.
Little bit. But his random killing of people, I get it, going after the people that were involved in his execution, totally fine. That's typical revenge plotline stuff. Seen it all before, but that's fine if that's what you're going to do for the episode. But all these random people so he can get juiced up in order to go after them and become like the villain Electro from the Spider-Man comic book seems really stupid.
I would agree. I would agree. You know, and having his body be just kind of a battery pack, that releases that energy when he wants, and so he has to actually wear rubber gloves. If you notice throughout the entire episode, the only time he takes off those rubber gloves is when he's about to kill someone.
Also, their clothes remain, but their body is destroyed.
Yeah, their body just poofs, you know, puff of smoke, and just their clothes remain.
Yeah,
wouldn't be how an actual electrical attack would happen. But, you know, this is a devil object, so, you know, suspend your disbelief here.
We see that later on with him, though. Spoiler alert, he dies. And he looks like Emperor Palpatine from the Star Wars movies when he gets electrocuted. I mean, that's if you saw Revenge of the Sith, you know that Emperor Palpatine was trying to kill Mace Windu with his dark force lightning. Let me use correct terminology when I talk about Star Wars. And Mace Windu deflects it back on him, and it starts like aging him and like crinkling up his skin, making him all pruny until Anakin kills him.
Henceforth, you shall be known as Darth Vader.
Thank you, my master.
Hey, before you go, my face is really warm. Is everything okay up here?
I don't know. What do you mean?
Ow! My face! It's on fire!
Well, there is a possibility that when you were fighting Mace Windu, he deflected some of your force lightning back into your face.
Are you kidding me? How much?
A lot. I don't think there was one bolt of force lightning that didn't bounce off Master Windu's lightsaber directly back into your face.
And you just sat there and watched?
Well, turning to the dark side was a pretty big decision.
Oh my god, I look like I have a scrotum for a face! What am I supposed to call myself, Darth Syphilis? If you'd made up your mind 5 seconds earlier, we could have ruled the galaxy, and maybe I could have gotten laid one more time before I died.
I can see you're upset. I'm just gonna go slaughter those younglings.
Yeah, whatever.
And that clip is courtesy of Robot Chicken, which airs on Cartoon Network.
Yeah, you know, in the beginning of the episode, I thought that the, you know, quote-unquote, juice I need to go on was actually life force. Like, he was taking life force from these kids.
Yes.
And then adding it to himself.
Like in the movie Life Force by Tobe Hooper.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about? With that smoking hot naked woman vampire who's basically like sucking the life force out of people, but she's not doing it like you would a vampire with a bite of the neck. It's like energy.
Yeah, I thought that's what he was meaning, and then as the episode went on, I'm like, oh, it's electrical. Somehow the chair is transforming their life energy there into an electrical force. And that electrical force he's absorbing, storing, and then releasing when he wants to kill someone.
If you've never seen the movie in question we're talking about, it's totally available out on Blu-ray and DVD. Again, it's called Life Force. It's by Tobe Hooper. And it literally features, for the 18 minutes of screen time that she has, this naked woman who's like this space vampire. Unbelievably gorgeous looking woman too, who didn't speak any English at the time, so she didn't have a lot to say about the role.
I find it a little funny that when he finally kills I think her name is Melissa, the punk rock girl.
Yep.
she is so wanting that nitrous oxide that she's like, oh, turn it up a little higher, turn it up a little higher. Not the music, the gas. And she's just wanting to just get high off of the nitrous. It's hilarious. And then she says, you're a nice guy, not like the suits, just before he electrocutes her.
It's like, you think, again, he would only go after, you know, the people that wronged him, and he's just whoever's going to get into the chair.
Yeah, but just like with the poison, or the, what is it, the cup? The teacup?
Yep.
These people are runaways. You know, they're runaways, they're orphans, they have no family, no one that really is going to look for them or care for them, the state that really doesn't want them. So they're natural targets.
The girl, Melissa, played by Jennifer Cornish, will come back later on in another episode of the show.
Cool.
Our actor, our guy who's the bad guy, played by Angelo Rizakos, has, by the way, some of the goofiest looking hair, considering we know it's a wig since he has his head shaved at the beginning of the episode. It just looks awful the rest of the time. I mean, he literally looks like a clown.
It's just that those tight curls he has.
He'll come back in other episodes of Friday the 13th as well later on in seasons 2 and season 3.
So the purpose of Eli is trying to kill everyone that was basically in charge of his own execution. Mickey and Ryan end up stumbling upon him at the scene of the crime when he tries to electrocute one of the members using the metal banister as the conductor. And as I find this very interesting, that as they're running away, Eli gives chase, and he tries, just like a supervillain, to electrify the puddle that Ryan ends up stumbling into to electrocute them like that on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, like, they run to the car, and they get into the car, the Mercedes, and he tries to electrocute the car. But because cars are designed in such a way where unless you're actually touching something that is metal within the car or wire systems, that you are generally protected because the cars are actually on rubber tires, so it's not actually grounded. And that is something that he doesn't really expect or know. And so he just wastes his whole charge trying to get them killed, with no success whatsoever.
That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. In 1988, I was in the fourth grade, and that was one of the first things they taught us about electricity. If you're in a lightning storm, get inside your vehicle immediately because you will be protected if lightning strikes.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah.
And apparently, Eli didn't know.
Yeah, I guess maybe that was taught in more modern schools, and he went to school, you know, back in the 60s.
I think the more likely cause is that he just didn't do any research on what is actually conductive and not conductive.
He's clearly had this chair for a while. I mean, his execution was, again, in what year? 1978. Okay, so, and this is 1988. So he has been out of prison. They say he gets out of prison after his failed execution 9 months later, and he's cleared of all charges. So he has been out of prison for 9 years. How long has he had the chair for?
Well, he's only had the chair for, I believe, a little over a year.
Okay, since Uncle Louis was selling everything off, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So
I'm not sure if they're the ones that actually sold him the chair, or it was actually Uncle Louis. I think it was Uncle Louis, really.
I don't think they ever met. Almost up until the point of the episode, up until the episode that we're in, and we're only in the first season, they have Mickey. Yeah, Mickey and Ryan have not said, oh, no, I remember him. We sold that thing to him. We have to go get it. Yet.
Yeah.
You know, it's mostly been stuff that Uncle Louis has sold.
Correct. Things that were older in the manifest.
Correct. By the way, if the car was electrocuted like that, and you can see it how it's, like, screwing up with the circuitry inside the vehicle, wouldn't that destroy the car, like, cause it? I mean, not destroy it, but wouldn't the wiring and the computer, if that car even had a computer back then, I don't know anything about cars from the 80s, so I don't know if even a computer was even built in a car yet.
A Mercedes at that year,
because
it was a classic Mercedes, it did not have enough electrical components to really be fritzed out to the point of not running.
Okay.
Now, a modern Mercedes, it would totally be dead in the water.
Okay. the entire computer.
You know, that's the beauty about having old cars, is that they're not reliant on electrical systems the way modern cars are.
Correct. They're more reliant on gas and oil and polluting the environment.
Well, true. You know, current cars are as well, for the most part. But, yeah, the computer systems in modern cars, if you were to fritz out your circuit board or your fuses or even try to get a jump start and do it the wrong way, you will be just dead in the water for a while, and it's a pain in the ass. Like, I've had that done to my car once, where we did not do the jump starting right, and it totally fritzed out my electrical, and yeah, it was a hassle.
Did you know there are some horror movies called The Dentist? There's The Dentist and The Dentist 2.
I'm not surprised. There's a lot of fears about going to the dentist. It's those sounds in your head, man.
Well,
the
first Dentist movie was directed by Brian Yuzna, best known as the director of Beyond Reanimator, Bride of Reanimator, Faust, Warlock. He was a producer of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, The Giver, one of the Silent Night, Deadly Night movies. I mean, he has a long history of great 80s craptacular films. And the dentist starred Corbin Bernstein and Linda Hoffman. Corbin Bernstein. This was like the kind of like, I mean, he's kind of a character actor, but this is like the two films that he's, I guess you could say, like, known for. You know, he's in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, but in terms of like for the horror movie fans, you know, he's the dentist.
The dentist.
But if you ever watch Psych, he was Henry Spencer on Psych for the entire run of that show.
Now, I heard that dentists have actually one of the highest suicide rates around, as, you know, a general occupation.
You mean them killing themselves?
Yep.
Or, like, their patients afterwards?
Killing themselves.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I don't mean the dentist killed their patients.
One of the top 15, actually.
I don't mean the dentist killed their patients, by the way. When I asked that, I meant, like, do the people going to the dentist kill themselves because they're afraid of the dentist, so...
No. Okay. As an occupation, if you are a dentist, I guess you're prone to depression. So it's one of the top 15 jobs, you know, that people end up killing themselves with. I don't know why.
That's, wow. I will have to ask my dentist if they know why the next time I see them, because dentists, like any other medical profession, goes to probably some type of conference once in a while.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
In some place really nice that they can afford because they're a doctor. And they probably bring this up at a panel discussion. I guarantee this is brought up. If this is so well known between two people doing a podcast about a TV show, the dentists themselves must have an answer. So the next time I go to the dentist, I will ask and find out the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely ask. I mean, it's just like, you know, how lawyers are more than likely Geminis, mm-hmm. in the horoscope. It's just one of those things. Like, certain people gravitate towards certain careers, and dentists are just at risk.
Weird.
Yeah. So be kind to your dentist.
Yes.
I'm sure they hear a lot of negative information about them and frighten people in their chairs all the time. That must be very disheartening.
The number one cause of death for all six people in this episode? Electrocution!
Ba-dum-bum-tsh.
And I don't know if you count Eli twice, but I mean, I guess we technically could. So seven people or six people, six into seven. I just think it's funny that all the people who died were all electrocuted. Usually, you know, it's a couple different things. You know what I mean? Like, someone's bludgeoned, or one person happens to have this to happen to them. But yeah, no, all electrocuted.
Yep. You know, the chair taketh, and then the conductor or the conduit gives it away. So, yeah, it's all electrocuted. And actually, at the end of the episode, when Eli finally gets electrocuted to death, and his skin wrinkles up, you know, like the Palpatine thing, his hair turns white.
Yeah. Like, again, like Palpatine did.
It's kind of creepy.
Did you ever see the movie Powder?
Yes, yeah. I remember that movie.
The What do you call it? The person who directed, unfortunately, is a disgusting, despicable man, Victor Salva, best known for directing the Jeepers Creepers movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, look up what he did. The less said, the better. And you'll never want to watch the movies ever again. But that movie comes to mind. Good film. I can kind of separate the film from the filmmaker sometimes, you know what I mean? I can't do it with Jeepers Creepers because he had such a hand in making those, but Powder, mm-hmm. not so much. But I got this question to ask you because this always happens to me whenever I watch something that has to do with when somebody mentions something about food in an episode or a movie. When Warden Hobbs invites Ryan over for dinner for his wife's mm-hmm. meatloaf, do you automatically start thinking about meatloaf? And I ask this also because you're being pregnant, you have some unusual cravings when you're pregnant.
Mm-hmm. So are you asking if I have a craving for meatloaf because of I heard it on the television show?
Yes.
No, I don't. Okay. I actually right now have cravings for salads with blue cheese.
Ah, yummy. I actually did start thinking about meatloaf immediately when that was mentioned. I was like, I haven't had meatloaf in over a... God, when was the last time I had meatloaf? I started thinking about it pretty thought-provokingly. When I watched V for Vendetta and he's making that, like, egg in a basket for, for, what's her name, Natalie Portman, I immediately go, oh, I want to make that so badly.
Oh, no, and it is totally good. I was right with you on that one.
Okay, but we didn't get to see the meatloaf, so, but yeah, I immediately started thinking of how much I wanted meatloaf after hearing that.
Okay, now, in my twisted sense of humor and the way I look at the world, when the warden invites Ryan to dinner at 6 o'clock precisely, if this were a slightly different show, I would think that he was inviting him over for a little bit of playtime between his wife and him. You know, this hot young buck, Ryan, and invited to his house for dinner after not knowing him whatsoever.
For the brief second until I forgot he has a wife, I actually was thinking the warden was inviting Ryan over for a some type of homosexual encounter date of some kind. That's immediately where my mind went to until he says, oh, my wife is making meatloaf. And I'm like, oh, that's right, he's married. But for a brief second, I'm thinking, is the warden hitting on Ryan?
You know,
not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, the warden can invite people over to his house and have some fun times with, you know, a hot 20-something-year-old and be perfectly fine because, you know, he controls the prison, so therefore he probably gets an influx of people that he's meets and, you know, I don't know, keeps it on the down low.
Yeah. His wife is just a masquerade. There is no wife. He's just like, I'm not actually married. I'm just really into you.
And so when the wife opens the door and finds Eli, she's like, oh, well, he described you as much younger. It reminded me about if you had ordered a stripper and then you open the door and it's like, oh, well, you're not exactly what I ordered, but all right.
Are you trying to say that you're thinking that the warden wants Ryden to cuckold his wife?
I'm not going to go into specifics whether I think it's a cuckolding or a threesome situation. But if this were a slightly different show, I would say that there would be a possibility.
Ah.
But the way this was actually done, it does seem completely innocent. But, you know, my mind's perverted, so that's where I went with it.
Of course it is. Now, Elise's book brings up a really great question. Where the hell do they stick that damn chair? That vault is not that big. And most of the stuff they can stick on a shelf very easily.
I don't know. It's a magical vault, so...
Right. It's like the TARDIS?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, where were they going to stick that wood chipper? They couldn't even bring it down the stairs of the antique store.
They keep it in the garage out back with the car.
It has to be magic.
Well, don't forget...
That's what I'm going with.
I'm just curious if they can, like, keep it someplace else, or does is the vault, like, protected by a magic spell in order to nullify the curse? Because, wait a minute, hold on. I have to back up to the very beginning of this podcast, and when I asked, does the curse still influence the stuff after Lewis is dead? Yes, it does, because Vera is still alive, the doll. Or Vila?
Yes.
Vera,
yes,
right?
Yes, doll is still alive.
What was the name of the doll?
I'd have to go back to my notes on that one.
The doll from the very first episode is still alive,
yeah,
because every time they open the vault
door, it turns
door,
and looks at them.
Yes, and it did when Roby's fiance was in it, was in the vault.
Yep.
Vita, sorry. That's the name of the doll, Vita. Well, we're going to take a quick break and jump right to the next episode of the Dead TV podcast covering Friday the 13th, Brain Drain. I'd like to thank you all for tuning in. Check out some of these promos for other podcasts here on the podcast network of podcasts. We don't actually have a name. We're just playing their promo. They're playing our promo. I'd also like to say that this episode is dedicated in great memory to the recently departed New York Times best-selling author of The Girl Next Door, Red, The Women and Offspring, Jack Ketchum. Jack was a dear friend of mine on the Dr. Chris Radio of Horror Network and one of the most frequent guests on my show, and he unfortunately lost his second battle with cancer at the age of 71 this past Wednesday. So, Jack, again, we dedicate this episode to you.
Hi, I'm Ali, and this is Rob.
Howdy.
And we're the hosts of Horror Never Sleeps, a new weekly horror movie retrospective podcast. We will be reviewing your favourite scary movies like Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween, and Psycho.
Also, we'll be covering classic gems like Maniac Cop, The Lost Boys,
The Human Centipede.
Whoa. No.
Oh, we'll see. First episode will be released mid-November. You can listen on iTunes or your favourite podcast app.
Until then, stay scared. Ooh.
Yeah, we won't be doing that.
Hi, I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca.
We're the hosts of a new true crime podcast called Yours in Murder.
We put out a new episode every week. We switch between covering true crime cases together and analyzing true crimes in our minisodes.
We take turns on the minisodes, focusing on our unique perspectives.
I have a degree in forensic science.
And I have one in journalism.
So we're able to go beyond Wikipedia and dive into the facts of the case. We look at the forensic evidence and the spin put on cases by the media.
Check us out on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and like us on Facebook for an update on today in true crime history.
As always, we are Yours in Murder.
This is the story of a machine that can wreck your mind.
Now it's my turn to be smart.
A cursed configuration that has fallen into the wrong hands.
You're going to make me famous, aren't you?
Witness this twisted transformation. A brilliant mind coming from the brains of poor, unsuspecting souls.
You gotta reverse the process. He's stolen our mind. We gotta get him back.
The Brain Drain. On Friday the 13th, the series. Whatever you do, don't change your mind. Watch next week.
And we're back with the Dead TV podcast. And earlier, I made a quick little comment about Philadelphia and the Eagles. And the reason why I mention that is because I am from New England, and Mitchell Zeneca is from Philadelphia. And even though I'm a bigger football fan and she is not a football fan, our opposing teams representing our states are actually in the Super Bowl. So the day this airs, we will be 2 days before the actual Super Bowl when this episode is posted online. So that is happens to be why I did mention that comment for anyone curious why I was mentioning the sporting event in a show that has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, and Dr. Chris tried to get me to put a wager on the game, and I'm
yes.
like, dude, I don't care. I hope your team wins because Eagles fans are nuts.
You said there was like car tipping and stuff like that? Some crazy
shit? Oh my
shit.
God, they freak out. The cops here, no joke, had to actually grease the light poles and all of the street signs so that Eagles fans would not climb them after the game, and yet three still did.
You know what's funny? Back in 2004, when the Boston Red Sox broke the curse and won the World Series for the first time in over 80 years, we had some serious effed up stuff happening. But think about how many times championships have come out of this area, with the Red Sox winning three World Series, the Bruins, the Celtics, and now the Patriots on to their eighth Super Bowl and possibly sixth win. We've gotten used to championships. We pretty much have mellowed out. Other states need to take our example.
Now, Philly fans are just incredibly insane.
All right.
Yeah, I hope your team wins.
Thank you. Thank you.
I don't want to deal with the massive riots here.
And once again, the music is from the Fox fanfare for the NFL. I don't actually know what channel the Super Bowl is going to be on right now as I'm playing that. So it doesn't really matter. That music is mostly associated with sports. But on to the episode at hand. Mr. Zeneca has the episode synopsis for us.
All right. Season 1, Episode 18, Brain Drain, originally aired on April 25th, 1988. A man seeks to increase his intelligence and become a world-renowned scientist, but his quest results in the deaths of other researchers. Dun, now, dun, dun.
Now, I'm curious if there was any other, any other film, any other, not episodes of TV shows, but if there was ever a film called Brain Drain, do you know?
It sounds very familiar, although it could have been from, like, an MST3K episode.
There was a movie in 2009 and a movie in 1998, a foreign film, which mm-hmm. is just called Brain Drain. A teenage Argentinian street gang are targeted for revenge by the overweight street cop whom they wrongfully accused of police brutality years ago. Ooh. And then Brain Drain, which is from Spain. Emilio is a shy but not too brilliant pupil of a humble local secondary school, has always harbored a secret love for Nalia, the cutest, brightest girl in the class. Yeah, we'll never be covering those.
No.
I also think in Elise's book, it's mentioned that this is the first time this person ever wrote an episode or something. Do you remember that in the back of the notes for the episode in her book?
Yes. Let's see here.
Lyndon Chubbuck was the director. He went on to direct that episode of Naked Souls that we made fun of.
The screenwriter was Josh Miller.
Okay. I thought I remember reading that this was like a first time.
One of the things that's mentioned is that in 1988, you know, the concept of artificial intelligence wasn't its just very, very beginnings. Like, they didn't really know what artificial intelligence was. It's just something that science fiction created, and then science supported and actually created and burst into being.
Yeah, I think we had just had, around this time, the first Terminator movie had come out prior to this episode, and James Cameron was one of the people instrumental in giving us artificial intelligence gone wrong, obviously, as, you know, the Terminators have taken over the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, it's, you know, having, like, this brain suspended in some liquid with these wires attached to it, it didn't seem like there was actually a blood system or a circulatory system that you'd have to support a brain.
Yeah.
And then the brain itself pulses as if it's breathing or there's a heartbeat, and that's not the way brains work.
True.
But
and you made,
this is TV.
You also mentioned Mystery Science Theater 3000, and one of the most famous episodes of that show was the first episode starring Michael Nelson as the host, taking over from Joel. The name of the movie was The Brain That Wouldn't Die, and it was about a woman
yes.
who's decapitated, and her husband saves her head and then sticks it in a gravy train dish. With his other
with his headset on her, you know, metal and
the Princess Leia looking do.
Yep.
And again, the episode's mostly famous for the fact that this is when Michael took over the show from Joel. He goes around like killing off, trying to find like a supermodel with like the best looking body in order to give back to his wife. Like, he loves his wife so much he's willing to kill the women. Never mind the fact he's got other horrific experiments going on in his laboratory, and his wife goes crazy and somehow develops psychokinetic powers. I'm not sure how that works when you're just a head.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a lot to this, science fiction, pseudoscience, and you're like, what?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, well, this is just movie magic.
Sure.
Yeah.
Moving on with what happened in the episode.
So, the mental test subject, Harry, that has an IQ of 58. Now, 58 is supremely low.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, in the beginning of this episode, having trouble, I think, just assembling colors of blocks together into groups.
Mm-hmm.
And
by the way,
you know
this actor.
He's very recognizable.
Read off his
IMDb.
We talked about him previously. He's Eddie Monroe in Cupid's Quiver.
Yes, that's true.
Yes.
That's true.
And he returned. Besides our main cast of characters and directors and writers who come back for various episodes, I swear to God, I think he's got the longest IMDb credit for the show as a supporting actor because he's in 4 episodes of the show.
I mean, he is a good actor.
He was a good actor. He unfortunately passed away in 2002.
Oh.
Yeah. But having been in The Mask, Cliffhanger, Storm of the Century, Eraser, The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr., and many, many, many other shows.
Nice, yeah. He is very recognizable. You definitely recognize his face. And I think this is actually one of those episodes that I saw as a kid. Just like with the Vanity's Mirror, I actually did see this one either first run or early in syndication.
Cool. I remember seeing this episode on the Sci-Fi Channel when the Sci-Fi Channel was in its infancy and actually used to air really good stuff. Now the Sci-Fi Channel airs nothing but garbage, except for Saturday night's creature feature movie.
Oh, you know, MTV doesn't run videos anymore, so anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So we're testing him with the blocks, kind of like you would test with monkeys, and I always felt as though I don't think they do that anymore because it basically plays down someone's IQ to them to have them do something with blocks, you know, like a baby or a child that they're testing their IQ with. They're doing it with a full-grown adult. I don't think they do that anymore. But also, this test reminds me very much of Bill Murray testing the two people in Ghostbusters.
Yeah, with the electric shocks.
Yeah, exactly. It very much screams of that. And then the stuff with the monkey, with the brain in the jar that you mentioned, also has more reminiscence of like artificial intelligence and increasing the intelligence of the monkey, the gorilla, the ape, whatever it happens to be. I don't remember. It is more along the lines of like how we got Planet of the Apes happening.
Yeah, except in this case, the brain is actually removed from the body instead of being part of the actual, ape himself, and then increasing the intelligence of the full creature.
Yeah, they're using in the rise of the first Planet of the Apes movie of the new trilogy. It's I think it's Alzheimer's disease that they use to experiment with the monkeys, the apes, and that increases the intelligence because Alzheimer's has a lot to do with the brain.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, the Museum of Science and Natural History. Isn't that in Washington, D.C., or is there more than one?
Lots of cities have museums of science and natural history.
Okay.
It's one of those very common terms.
Okay.
But when they mentioned the cross streets, Luxor and Sixth,
yep.
I couldn't pull up anything that was kind of close to being a museum at anywhere in the country with that kind of address.
Okay. I love, by the way, in Elise's book, Curious Goods, the behind the scenes of Friday the 13th, she points out that the museum, and this doesn't happen until later on, has to be locked because everything comes to life sometimes. You have to keep that place locked.
Yeah.
Also, a museum of natural history and a museum of science sometimes are two different things.
Sometimes, yes.
Like the Museum of Science in Washington, D.C. is completely different than the Museum of Natural History.
I guess it really depends on how many collections you want to put into a different space. If you have enough to support a full museum of science, you give it a building. If you don't have enough exhibitions to warrant separate museums, then you just put them all together.
One of the most commonly referred to science of museum in the Museum of Science and Natural History as one actual museum is in London, England.
Yeah.
Which I don't think where this episode was taking place.
No, not at all.
I think we can also figure out exactly the city it's in by the license plate of the car, usually, right?
Usually, but what they've done is a very good job of obscuring the different locations between license plates, because I have actually looked up in various episodes different license plates and their numbering systems, and whether the color of the plate was corresponding to one state, the numbering system was corresponding to a different state. So they did that on purpose, I believe, to just kind of confuse where this TV show is actually taking place.
It would also be kind of funny if they happened to be in New Jersey, because that's where the Friday the 13th movie series actually takes place.
Yeah. The whole episode revolves around the cursed object, which is a trephinator.
A weird object.
Yeah, it's a trephinator, which in the episode, it takes the spinal fluid from one person and puts it into another, and that is supposed to transfer intelligence. Because Harry is a dullard, he does it just to become smarter, and then he gains not only the knowledge of the professor that was testing him, but also his obsession with getting this project completed. Because Harry did not have any proclivity towards, you know, science, because he only had an IQ of 58. And then once he actually received the intelligence of his researcher, the professor, Dr. Vincent Robeson, then he just decided that bringing this brain into a state where it can talk and communicate and be, you know, increased in intelligence is going to put him on the map. So basically gained all of the obsessions that the doctor had. Personality traits, obsessions, mannerisms, things like that.
Would you say that he is a man with two brains?
A la Steve Martin?
Yes. That movie always really, I haven't watched that since I was a child, and I should probably rewatch it as an adult. I always thought it was funny. It was like the first movie to really portray, I think, like the female, I mean, there's like a female main character, but there's the brain girl, like the girl in the brain, you know, the brain of the girl that he puts into like his fiance's body. And then mm-hmm. she goes from being, like, really skinny to really big.
Yeah.
And he still loved her. And I swear to God, I think that's, like, one of the first movies to ever really show, like, our main male lead actor, who was Steve Martin. And, you know, whether or not he was a good-looking guy or not is up for debate. He's not on my list of top 10 guys I would go gay for, let's just say. You know, at the time in the 80s, he was a huge star. So, you know, I never saw him as like The Rock, is what I'm trying to say. But, or Channing Tatum. But he's the male lead.
So we now know your types.
Yeah, okay. But he's the male lead in this movie, in this romantic comedy. And, you know, he still loves this woman, despite the fact her appearance changes from being skinny to fat.
Well, I mean, he fell in love with the brain.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
So he didn't really love the body so much. The body was great, you know, his wife's body was great, but when he gets out of the hospital at the very end of the movie and you know, she's worried that he won't like her anymore because she's fat. You know, I never told him that I was fat. And you know, he's like, "What fat?" You know, and I think that's a very touching moment there. And he even, like, lifts her up to carry her over the threshold, so...
By the way, that almost makes no sense that the brain going into her body would turn her fat because she was a big girl to begin with. What?
No, that completely makes sense.
That doesn't... How does that make any sense? The brain is not going to alter the body chemistry to turn a woman who's, like, 100 pounds soaking wet into 200 pounds.
The brain controls habits. If someone has a habit of overeating, if someone has a habit of eating because of their emotional state, that's all in the brain. You know, it's just like those people that go on Biggest Loser and they lose all that weight. Well, if their brain hasn't changed in order to accept that new, you know, dichotomy, then they will actually plump back up because it's the brain. It is your habits. And if you put a fat person's brain that has all those habits and emotional eating and all that, and put it into a skinny body, the body will start to match what the brain's, you know, habits are directing. So it makes complete sense.
Okay. I guess so. I mean, again, back to the original point, it was just, I think, unique for the time that our main male character, you know, was into a woman for her mind and not her body, which for a film in the 80s, you know, is kind of says a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And in this episode, I really, really, really like this episode because it shows Jack and this, like, love story between him and Viola. And then he loses her at the end of the episode. She becomes one of the victims.
That is, I thought, the saddest part. Because this was a woman he was engaged to. He was going to spend the rest of his life with. But circumstances came up, unfortunately, that pulled them apart. Mainly their careers.
Their careers, yeah.
They were both more in love with their careers. I mean, he was an occult expert and had to pursue whatever the hell Jack... By the way, what the hell...
Things around the world.
Yeah, what was Jack's job? Okay. At least hers a little bit more defined. But yeah, what the hell was Jack's job ever?
I think he was an occult specialist and also a researcher. Remember, he tried to do that pheromone rat experiment in one of the episodes, and he travels the world. So she said that he was going to go on his third trip around the world, and she was going to take a job somewhere else to continue her linguistic anthropology. And so their paths just diverged. So 20 years later, they meet up. The spark is still there. She still goes gaga over his beard, and, you know, the love is still there. The love never really lost. It's just circumstances around them changed.
True, and even though she's, like, one of the... I was really hoping that they were going to get to her in time, and maybe, like, Jack wouldn't want to be with her because, like, his life is so dangerous right now trying to find these objects, and it's best if they... not get married. I would have liked that more than her dying and her being, and then it being sad and it, like, ending on, like, the photo. You know, just a lot of that was just really not,
you know,
underacted or not overacted, but I just don't think Jack's portrayal of, like, how he felt about it was as convincing as the way the episode ends with her obituary.
Well, I think his hope in the afterlife is what's driving him to keep that spark alive. You know, she said yes to the engagement, and then she died, so he's just very accepting of the beyond and wants to be with her again, and he, at the very end, says, you know, wait for me, I'll see you there. You know, and it's very touching, and it's, Jack is in mourning, and he just got her back, and now she's gone again. And it's just like, you know, their diverging careers are on two different paths, but you're hoping at some point in time they're going to meet up again.
It is also pretty funny when after they have dinner and she wants to, this is before she dies, obviously, says, hey, why don't you come in for a nightcap? And you know, it's like, how about you come upstairs for a nightcap and a bang?
Yeah.
There was more involved in that than just a nightcap. She wanted the Jack.
Of course, of course. You know, he put on the favorite cologne that she liked, and, you know, it's two people that were in love, still are in love, and they're old enough to really, like, be no business about it. You know, no games. It's like, no, why don't you come up and, you know, spend the night?
Why don't you come up and see me sometime?
Why don't you come up and see me sometime?
Yeah, what Hollywood actress is that from?
Oh, jeez. I can't remember at the moment.
It's okay. It hadn't really
Dude,
come
I can't remember at the moment.
No, it's fine.
I can imagine her face, but I can't remember her name at the moment.
I also have to point out that the science, and I'm no scientist, and I don't know anything, behind how this whole thing works makes no sense at all. It's not even electricity involved. It's just like they drain the spinal and brain fluid out of one person and put it into the other. That's not how you would increase intelligence at all. That just makes no sense whatsoever. That's like saying if I gave you my blood, let's say you gave me your blood, I would become more feminine or get pregnant. It's along those the stupidity of lines of, like, that type of science. You know what I mean? Or That just doesn't make any sense.
True.
Your blood to me would not change me in any way other than making me either sick if it's the wrong blood or the right, or if we're the same type, you would be saving my life. This would make more sense if he could only go after people that were the same type of, like, brain matter as him or something. You know what I mean?
Some sort of compatibility.
Correct. That would at least be a fraction more sense than whatever the hell they're doing in this episode.
Trepanation is actually a thing.
Yes, I'm aware. It's just not the way that they are saying it is.
No, no. Trepanation or trepanning is basically making a hole in the skull in order to release blood buildup, pressure on the brain, that type of thing.
Right.
You know, and then back in like ancient times, it was also to let out evil spirits and, you know, cure people's mental disorders and things like that. So it has been a long time practice. And if you remember in Ghostbusters 2, Egon actually said, you know, it's mentioned that Venkman stopped him from drawing a hole in his own head. And Egon says, that would have worked if you hadn't stopped me. You know, so drawing the hole in the head and releasing brain, you know, blood, you know, pressure, etc., is actually a thing. So there is a little bit of science behind this, but not science in the way they're actually doing it. It's considered one of those pseudoscientific, magical practices that has a little bit of research attached to it, but it doesn't really work that well. Doesn't have a lot of substantiated results. But it has been done for centuries.
There are a total of four people who died in this episode. By the way, in the previous episode, there were three unconfirmed kids dead that I completely missed. But we're not counting people killed off screen, only counting the ones that were actually killed that we did see. But there are four people who died in this episode.
Yes.
Needles to the spinal column.
And they were all scientists except for Harry at the very end, which I guess he became a scientist, but
yeah, by stealing other people's memories and scientific knowledge.
Yep.
Makes him more of a thief than a scientist.
Correct.
I do not own any one of the items in these episodes. I've never owned an electric chair, and I've never owned this brain draining thingy, which I can never pronounce.
The trepanator.
The trepanator. Have you ever used a electric chair or an old electric chair in any of your kink stuff?
I have.
Okay, so if we're not familiar in the kink world, there are electric kink play toys and stuff. Did you use it with that?
Yeah, this wasn't related to that.
Oh, okay, damn. I was like, woo, Mrs. Etika.
Yeah.
You strapped him to the electric chair and then gave him the electric shock thing that I've seen in pornos.
No. While I do electrical play of various sorts, the electric chair that I had, which I had rented from a studio and theater prop company, was used as a play device for my villain's ball.
Mm.
So it was put into the Frankenstein mad scientist corner, and so it had a helmet that had little light bulbs on top of it, so you know, quote unquote, it's working. And I had attached strobe lights to it, so you could push a button, it strobes, it makes some sounds, the light bulbs kind of, you know, do their thing, and the person in the chair can fake being electrocuted. So, I've got a good video of one of my friends just kind of joking around in it, talking about how the electricity runs through your body in the electric chair and what you got to do in order to survive being electrocuted. It's really hilarious.
What is the toy that Ryan is playing with earlier in the episode?
Oh, that's one of those, he calls it an electrical lightning lamp.
Yeah, but that's not the real term for it. They actually have a name. You can usually find them around Halloween or at Spencer Gifts.
Spencer Gifts, yeah. They're like always around Spencer's.
It's a Lieben, a Lieben.
Lieben glass plasma balls
yes,
here?
Yes, that's a plasma ball. The leave-in part, I never remember, but yes, plasma balls are what they're called. And they're like pieces of electricity that kind of shoot out as soon as you touch it with anything that's got heat, usually.
Yes.
It flows through the filament, and light gives off light. The lamp gives off light and gets hot in the usual way. And it's attracted to your biology.
Your body's electricity.
Correct. So if you like try to maybe like swipe it with a piece of paper or like a feather or you know like a cloth or whatever, it wouldn't really attract it nearly as much as the heat coming from your fingers.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought it was very cute at the end of that episode where Mickey is touching it and then her hair just kind of, you know, 80s glams out with, you know, the supposed static electricity. It's
correct.
Really cute. She says, oh, it tickles.
Yeah, yeah, we didn't mention that in the previous one, but that's the closest thing to anything electrical that I own, and I don't own the device that can drain your brain fluid, so...
it's such a complicated device. I don't have anything close to that, but I do have violet wands and other electrical devices.
Oh, my.
And I have actually rented an electric chair for an event.
Oh, so, well, if you have any pictures of this electric chair, that you should post them to the Dead TV Podcast Facebook page.
I do.
Awesome. The Dead TV Podcast is where you can find out about when we're going to be posting a new episode, when we're recording an episode, when we're going to post little things about the TV series that we're currently talking about. We are on Friday the 13th for at least until I think the end of March, and then we switch over to Spawn, the animated series, which I'm really looking forward to after that. So stay tuned for more episodes of the Dead TV Podcast covering Friday the 13th, the series. Don't forget you can check us out on our site at RadioHorror.com. We also have a Patreon, which would be great if you'd love to go to Patreon and support us. We have some interesting items to give away to people if you do support us on Patreon. If you have a business, a website, a little thing that you're trying to make money on and you'd like to advertise it on the Dead TV Podcast, you can contact us at thatradiohorror@gmail.com and send us an email what it is you have that you'd like to promote, and we will send you a way to promote your item on the podcast, such as our sponsor, Wicked Chronic in Natick, Massachusetts. Mr. Zeneca can be found on her Twitter at
Elegantly Kinky.
Thank you to everyone for tuning in, and come back in 2 weeks for another episode.
Bye.
And go Pats!